Each person acts in his or her self-interest, and the result is a disaster for the group. The prisoner's dilemma is perhaps the most famous and troubling game in game theory, and we return to the topic in Chapter 3 to discuss what can be done. We should emphasize right from the start that we have no presumption that the outcome of a game will be good for the players. Many economists, ourselves included, tout the advantages of the free market. The theory behind this conclusion relies on a price system that guides individual behavior. In most strategic interactions, there is no invisible hand of prices to guide the baker or the butcher or anyone else. Thus, there is no reason to expect that the outcome of a game will be good for the players or society. It may not be enough to play a game well. You must also be sure you are playing the right game. Number 8. Mix your plays. Apparently, Takashi Hashiyama has trouble making decisions. Both Sotheby's and Christie's had made attractive offers to be the auction house for the sale of his company's $18 million art collection. Rather than choose one over the other, he suggested the two of them play a game of rock, paper, scissors to determine the winner. Yes, rock, paper, scissors. Rock breaks scissors, scissors cuts paper, and paper covers rock. Christie's chose scissors, and Sotheby's chose paper. Scissors cut paper, and so Christie's won the assignment and a nearly $3 million commission. With the stakes so high, could game theory have helped? The obvious point is that in this type of game, one can't be predictable. If Sotheby's had known that Christie's would be playing scissors, then they would have chosen rock. No matter what you choose, there is something else that beats it. Hence, it is important that the other side can't predict your play. As part of their preparation, Christie's turned to local experts, namely the kids of their employees who play the game regularly. According to 11-year-old Alice, "Everybody knows you always start with scissors." Alice's twin sister, Flora, added her perspective. "Rock is way too obvious, and scissors beats paper. Since they were beginners, scissors was definitely the safest." Sotheby's took a different tack. They thought this was simply a game of chance, and hence, there was no room for strategy. Paper was as good as anything else. What is interesting here is that both sides were half right. As Sotheby's picked its strategy at random, with an equal chance of rock, scissors, or paper, then whatever Christie's did would have been equally good. Each option has a one-third chance of winning, a one-third chance of losing, and a one-third chance of a tie. But Christie's didn't pick at random. Thus, Sotheby's would have done better to think about the advice Christie's would likely get, and then play to beat it. If it's true that everyone knows you start with scissors, Sotheby's should have started with Bart Simpson's favorite, good old rock. In that sense, both players got it half wrong. Given Sotheby's lack of strategy, there was no point in Christie's efforts. But given Christie's efforts, there would have been a point to Sotheby's thinking strategically. In a single play of a game, it isn't hard to choose randomly. But when games get repeated, the approach is trickier. Mixing your plays does not mean rotating your strategies in a predictable manner. Your opponent can observe and exploit any systematic pattern almost as easily as he can exploit an unchanging repetition of a single strategy. It is unpredictability that is important when mixing. It turns out most people fall into predictable patterns. You can test this yourself online, where computer programs are able to find the pattern and beat you. In an effort to mix things up, players often rotate their strategies too much. This leads to the surprise success of the avalanche strategy. Rock, rock, rock. People are also too influenced by what the other side did last time. If both Sotheby's and Christie's had opened with scissors, there would have been a tie and a rematch. According to Flora, Sotheby's would expect Christie's to play rock, to beat their scissors. That should lead Sotheby's to play paper, and so Christie's should stick with scissors. Of course, that formulaic approach can't be right either. If it were, Sotheby's could then play rock and win. Imagine what would happen if there were some known formula that determined who would be audited by the IRS. Before you submitted a tax return, you could apply the formula to see if you would be audited. If an audit was predicted, but you could see a way to amend your return until the formula no longer predicted an audit, you probably would do so. If an audit was unavoidable, you would choose to tell the truth. The result of the IRS being completely predictable is that it would audit exactly the wrong people. All those audited would have anticipated their fate and chosen to act honestly, while those spared an audit would have only their consciences to watch over them. When the IRS audit formula is somewhat fuzzy, everyone stands some risk of an audit. This gives an added incentive for honesty. The importance of randomized strategies was one of the early insights of game theory. The idea is simple and intuitive, but needs refinement to be useful in practice. It is not enough for a tennis player to know that he should mix his shots between the opponent's forehand and backhand. He needs some idea of whether he should go to the forehand 30% or 64% of the time, and how the answer depends on the relative strengths of the two sides. In Chapter 5, we develop methods to answer such questions. We'd like to leave you with one last commentary. The biggest loser in the rock-paper-scissors game wasn't Sotheby's. It was Mr. Hashiyama. His decision to deploy rock-paper-scissors gave each of the two auction houses a 50% chance of winning the commission. Instead of letting the two contestants effectively agree to split the commission, he could have run his own auction. Both firms were willing, even eager, to lead the sale with a 12% commission. The winning house would be the one willing to take the lowest fee. Do I hear 11%? Going once, going twice. Number 9. Never give a sucker an even bet. In Guys and Dolls, gambler Skye Masterson relates this valuable advice from his father. One of these days in your travels, a guy is going to show you a brand new deck of cards, on which the seal is not yet broken. Then this guy is going to offer to bet you that he can make the Jack of Spades jump out of this brand new deck of cards and squirt cider in your ear. But son, you do not accept this bet because, as sure as you stand there, you're going to wind up with an ear full of cider. The context of the story is that Nathan Detroit has offered Skye Masterson a bet about whether Mindy's sells more strudel or cheesecake. Nathan had just discovered the answer, strudel, and is willing to bet if Skye will bet on cheesecake. This example may sound somewhat extreme. Of course, no one would take such a sucker bet. Or would they? Look at the market for futures contracts on the Chicago Board of Exchange. If another speculator offers to sell you a futures contract, he will make money only if you lose money. If you happen to be a farmer with soybeans to sell in the future, then the contract can provide a hedge against future price movements. Similarly, if you sell soy milk and hence need to buy soybeans in the future, this contract is insurance, not a gamble. But the volume of the contracts on the exchange suggests that most people buying and selling are traders, not farmers and manufacturers. For them, the deal is a zero-sum game. When both sides agree to trade, each one thinks it will make money. One of them must be wrong. That's the nature of a zero-sum game. Both sides can't win. This is a paradox. How can both sides think that they can outsmart the other? Someone must be wrong. Why do you think the other person is wrong, not you? Let us assume that you don't have any insider information. If someone is willing to sell you a futures contract, any money you make is money they lose. Why do you think that you are smarter than they are? Remember that their willingness to trade means that they think they are smarter than you. In poker, players battle this paradox when it comes to raising the stakes. If a player bets only when he has a strong hand, the other players will soon figure this out. In response to a raise, most other players will fold, and he'll never win a big pot. Those who raise back will have even stronger hands, and so our poor player will end up a big loser. To get others to bet against a strong hand, they have to think you might be bluffing. To convince them of this possibility, it helps to bet often enough so that you must be bluffing some of the time. This leads to an interesting dilemma. You'd like others to fold against your bluffs and thereby win with weak hands, but that won't lead to high pot victories. To convince others to raise your bets, you also need to get caught bluffing. As the players get even more sophisticated, persuading others to take big bets against you becomes harder and harder. Consider the following high-stakes game of wits between Eric Lindgren and Daniel Negreanu, two of poker's top-ranked players. Negreanu, sensing a weak hand, raised him $200,000. "I put $270,000 in, so I have $200,000 left," Negreanu said. And Eric looks over my chips and says, "How much you got left?" And he moves all in, wagering all he had. Under the special betting rules governing the tournament, Negreanu had only 90 seconds to decide whether to call the bet and risk losing all his money if Lindgren wasn't bluffing, or to fold and give up the hefty sum he had already put into the pot. "I didn't think he could be so stupid," Negreanu said. "But it wasn't stupid. It was like a step above. He knows that I know that he wouldn't do something so stupid. So by doing something so, quote, unquote, stupid, it actually became a great play." While it is obvious that you shouldn't bet against these poker champions, when should you take a gamble? Groucho Marx famously said that he didn't care to belong to any club that would accept him as a member. For similar reasons, you might not want to take any bet that others offer. You should even be worried when you win an auction. The very fact that you were the highest bidder implies that everyone else thought the item was worth less than you did. The result of winning an auction and discovering you've overpaid is called the winner's curse. Every action someone takes tells us something about what he knows. And you should use these inferences, along with what you already know, to guide your actions. How to bid so that you won't be cursed when you win is something we discuss in Chapter 10. There are some rules of the game that can help put you on more equal footing. One way to allow trading with lopsided information is to let the less informed party pick which side of the bet to take. If Nathan Detroit agreed in advance to take the bet whatever side Sky picked, then Nathan's inside information would be of no help. In stock markets, foreign exchange markets, and other financial markets, people are free to take either side of the bet. Indeed, in some exchanges, including the London Stock Market, when you ask for a quote on a stock, the market maker is required to state both the buying and selling prices before he knows which side of the transaction you want. Without such a safeguard, market makers could stand to profit from private information, and the outside investor's fear of being suckered might cause the entire market to fold. The buy and sell prices are not quite the same. The difference is called the bid-ask spread. In liquid markets, the spread is quite small, indicating that little information is contained in any buy or sell order. We return to the role of information in Chapter 8. Number 10. Game theory can be dangerous to your health. Late one night, after a conference in Jerusalem, two American economists, one of whom is this book's co-author, found a taxi cab and gave the driver directions to the hotel. Immediately recognizing us as American tourists, the driver refused to turn on his meter. Instead, he proclaimed his love for Americans and promised us a lower fare than the meter. Naturally, we were somewhat skeptical of this promise. Why should this stranger offer to charge less than the meter when we were willing to pay the metered fare? How would we even know whether or not we were being overcharged? On the other hand, we had not promised to pay the driver anything more than what would be on the meter. We put on our game theory hats. If we were to start bargaining and the negotiations broke down, we would have to find another taxi. But if we waited until we arrived at the hotel, our bargaining position would be much stronger, and taxis were hard to find. We arrived. The driver demanded 2,500 Israeli shekels, $2.75. Who knew what fare was fair? Because people generally bargain in Israel, Barry protested and counter-offered 2,200 shekels. The driver was outraged. He claimed that it would be impossible to get from there to here for that amount. Before negotiations could continue, he locked all the doors automatically and retraced the route at breakneck speed, ignoring traffic lights and pedestrians. Were we being kidnapped to Beirut? No. He returned to the original position and ungraciously kicked us out of his cab, yelling, "See how far your 2,200 shekels will get you now." We found another cab. This driver turned on his meter, and 2,200 shekels later, we were home. Certainly, the extra time was not worth the 300 shekels. On the other hand, the story was well worth it. It illustrates the dangers of bargaining with those who have not yet read our book. More generally, pride and irrationality cannot be ignored. Sometimes it may be better to be taken for a ride when it costs only 2 dimes. There is a second lesson to the story. We didn't really think far enough ahead. Think of how much stronger our bargaining position would have been if we had begun to discuss the price after getting out of the taxi. Of course, for hiring a taxi, this logic should be reversed. If you tell the driver where you want to go before getting in, you may find your taxi chasing after some other customer. Get in first, then say where you want to go. Some years after this story was first published, we received the following letter. "Dear professors, you certainly don't know my name, but I think you will remember my story. I was a student in Jerusalem, moonlighting as a taxi driver. Now I am a consultant and chanced upon your book when it was translated into Hebrew. What you might find interesting is that I too have been sharing the story with my clients. Yes, it was indeed a late night in Jerusalem. As for the rest, well, I recall things a bit differently. Between classes and working nights as a taxi driver, there was almost no time for me to spend with my new bride. My solution was to have her ride with me in the front seat. Although she was silent, it was a big mistake for you to have left her out of the story. My meter was broken, but you didn't seem to believe me. I was too tired to argue. When we arrived, I asked for 2,500 shekels, a fair price. I was even hoping you would round the fare up to 3,000. You rich Americans could well afford a 50-cent tip. I couldn't believe you tried to cheat me. Your refusal to pay a fair price dishonored me in front of my wife. As poor as I was, I did not need to take your meager offer. Americans think that we should be happy to take whatever crumbs you offer. I say that we should teach you a lesson in the game of life. My wife and I are now married 20 years. We still laugh about those stupid Americans who spent a half an hour riding back and forth in taxis to save 20 cents. Sincerely, name withheld." Truth be told, we never received such a letter. Our point in creating it was to illustrate a critical lesson in game theory. You need to understand the other player's perspective. You need to consider what they know, what motivates them, and even how they think about you. George Bernard Shaw's quip on the Golden Rule was to not do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Their tastes may be different. When thinking strategically, you have to work extra hard to understand the perspective and interactions of all the other players in the game, including ones who may be silent. That brings us to one last point. You may be thinking you are playing one game, but it is only part of a larger game. There is always a larger game. The shape of things to come. These examples have given us glimpses of principles that guide strategic decisions. We can summarize these principles with a few morals from our tales. Think 48 when you are wondering what the other player is trying to achieve. Recall Richard Hatch's ability to play out all the future moves to figure out what he should do. The story of the hot hand told us that in strategy, no less than in physics, for every action we take, there is a reaction. We do not live and act in a vacuum. Therefore, we cannot assume that when we change our behavior, everything else will remain unchanged. De Gaulle's success in negotiations suggests that the stuck wheel gets the grease. But being stubborn is not always easy, especially when one has to be more stubborn than an obstinate adversary. That stubborn adversary might well be your future self, especially when it comes to dieting. Fighting or dieting with your back up against the wall can help strengthen your resolve. In Cold Blood and the story of Belling the Cat demonstrate the difficulty of obtaining outcomes that require coordination and individual sacrifice. In technology races, no less than in sailboat races, those who trail tend to employ more innovative strategies. The leaders tend to imitate the followers. Rock, Paper, Scissors points out the strategic advantage of being unpredictable. Such behavior may also have the added advantage that it makes life just a little more interesting. Our taxi rides make it clear that the other players in games are people, not machines. Pride, spite, and other emotions may color their decisions. When you put yourself in others' shoes, you have to take them as they are, not as you are. We could go on offering more examples and drawing morals from them, but this is not the best way to think methodically about strategic games. That is better done by approaching the subject from a different angle. We pick up the principles, for example, commitment, cooperation, and mixing, one at a time. In each instance, we explore examples that bear centrally on that issue until the principle is clear. Then you will have a chance to apply that principle in the case study that ends each chapter. Case study, multiple choice. We think almost everything in life is a game, even things that might not seem that way at first. Consider the following question from the GMAT, the test given to MBA applicants. Unfortunately, issues of copyright clearance have prevented us from reproducing the question. But that shouldn't stop us. Which of the following is the correct answer? A. 4 pi square inches. B. 8 pi square inches. C. 16 square inches. D. 16 pi square inches. E. 32 pi square inches. Okay, we recognize that you're at a bit of a disadvantage not having the question. Still, we think that by putting on your game theory hat, you can still figure it out. Case discussion. The odd answer in the series is C. Since it is so different from the other answers, it is probably not right. The fact that the units are in square inches suggests an answer that has a perfect square in it, such as 4 pi or 16 pi. This is a fine start and demonstrates good test-taking skills, but we haven't really started to use game theory. Think of the game being played by the person writing the question. What is that person's objective? He or she wants people who understand the problem to get the answer right, and those who don't to get it wrong. Thus, wrong answers have to be chosen carefully so as to be appealing to folks who don't quite know the answer. For example, in response to the question, how many feet are in a mile? An answer of giraffe, or even 16 pi, is unlikely to attract any takers. Turning this around, imagine that 16 square inches really is the right answer. What kind of question might have 16 square inches as the answer, but would lead someone to think 32 pi is right? Not many. People don't often go around adding pi to answers for the fun of it. Did you see my new car? It gets 10 pi miles to the gallon. We think not. Hence, we can truly rule out 16 as being the correct solution. Let's now turn to the two perfect squares, 4 pi and 16 pi. Assume for a moment that 16 pi square inches is the correct solution. The problem might have been, what is the area of a circle with a radius of 4? The correct formula for the area of a circle is pi r squared. However, the person who didn't quite remember the formula might have mixed it up with a formula for the circumference of a circle, 2 pi r. Yes, we know that the circumference is in inches, not square inches, but the person making this mistake would be unlikely to recognize this issue. Note that if r equals 4, then 2 pi r is 8 pi, and that would lead the person to the wrong answer of B. The person could also mix and match and use the formula 2 pi r squared and hence believe that 32 pi, or E, was the right answer. The person could leave off the pi and come up with 16, or C. Or the person could forget to square the radius and simply use pi r as the area, leading to 4 pi, or A. In summary, if 16 pi is the correct answer, then we can tell a plausible story about how each of the other answers might be chosen. They are all good wrong answers for the test maker. What if 4 pi is the correct solution, so that r equals 2? Think now about the most common mistake, mixing up circumference with area. If the student used the wrong formula, 2 pi r, he or she would still get 4 pi, albeit with incorrect units. There is nothing worse, from a test maker's perspective, than allowing the person to get the right answer for the wrong reason. Hence, 4 pi would be a terrible right answer, as it would allow too many people who didn't know what they were doing to get full credit. At this point, we are done. We are confident that the right answer is 16 pi. And we are right. By thinking about the objective of the person writing the test, we can suss out the right answer, often without even seeing the question. Now, we don't recommend that you go about taking the GMAT and other tests without bothering to even look at the questions. We appreciate that if you are smart enough to go through this logic, you most likely know the formula for the area of a circle. But you never know. There will be cases where you don't know the meaning of one of the answers or the material for the question wasn't covered in your course. In those cases, thinking about the testing game may lead you to the right answer. Chapter 2. Games Solvable by Backward Reasoning. It's your move, Charlie Brown. In a recurring theme in the comic strip Peanuts, Lucy holds a football on the ground and invites Charlie Brown to run up and kick it. At the last moment, Lucy pulls the ball away. Charlie Brown, kicking only air, lands on his back, and this gives Lucy great perverse pleasure. Anyone could have told Charlie that he should refuse to play Lucy's game. Even if Lucy had not played this particular trick on him last year, and the year before that. He knows her character from other contexts, and should be able to predict her action. At the time when Charlie is deciding whether or not to accept Lucy's invitation, her action lies in the future. However, just because it lies in the future does not mean Charlie should regard it as uncertain. He should know that of the two possible outcomes, letting him kick and seeing him fall, Lucy's preference is for the latter. Therefore, he should forecast that when the time comes, she is going to pull the ball away. The logical possibility that Lucy will let him kick the ball is realistically irrelevant. Reliance on it would be, to borrow Dr. Johnson's characterization of remarriage, a triumph of hope over experience. Charlie should disregard it, and forecast that acceptance will inevitably land him on his back. He should decline Lucy's invitation. Two kinds of strategic interactions. The essence of a game of strategy is the interdependence of the player's decisions. These interactions arise in two ways. The first is sequential, as in the Charlie Brown story. The players make alternating moves. Charlie, when it is his turn, must look ahead to how his current actions will affect the future actions of Lucy and his own future actions in turn. The second kind of interaction is simultaneous, as in the prisoner's dilemma tale of Chapter 1. The players act at the same time in ignorance of the other's current actions. However, each must be aware that there are other active players who in turn are similarly aware, and so on. Therefore, each must figuratively put himself in the shoes of all and try to calculate the outcome. His own best action is an integral part of this overall calculation. When you find yourself playing a strategic game, you must determine whether the interaction is simultaneous or sequential. Some games, such as football, have elements of both, in which case you must fit your strategy to the context. In this chapter, we develop in a preliminary way the ideas and rules that will help you play sequential games. Simultaneous move games are the subject of Chapter 3. We begin with really simple, sometimes contrived examples, such as the Charlie Brown story. This is deliberate. The stories are not of great importance in themselves, and the right strategies are usually easy to see by simple intuition, allowing the underlying ideas to stand out much more clearly. The examples get increasingly realistic and more complex in the case studies and in the later chapters. The first rule of strategy. The general principle for sequential move games is that each player should figure out the other player's future responses and use them in calculating his own best current move. This idea is so important that it is worth codifying into a basic rule of strategic behavior. Rule 1. Look forward and reason backward. Anticipate where your initial decisions will ultimately lead and use this information to calculate your best choice. In the Charlie Brown story, this was easy to do for anyone except Charlie Brown. He had just two alternatives, and one of them led to Lucy's decision between two possible actions. Most strategic situations involve a longer sequence of decisions with several alternatives at each. A tree diagram of the choices in the game sometimes serves as a visual aid for correct reasoning in such games. Let us show you how to use these trees. Decision trees and game trees. A sequence of decisions, with the need to look forward and reason backward, can arise even for a solitary decision-maker not involved in a game of strategy with others. For Robert Frost, in The Yellow Wood, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the road less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. We can show this schematically. This need not be the end of the choice. Each road might in turn have further branches. The road map becomes correspondingly complex. Here is an example from our own experience. Travelers from Princeton to New York have several choices. The first decision point involves selecting the mode of travel, bus, train, or car. Those who drive then have to choose among the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, the Holland Tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, and the George Washington Bridge. Rail commuters must decide whether to switch to the PATH train at Newark or continue to Penn Station. Once in New York, rail and bus commuters must choose among going by foot, subway, local or express, bus, or taxi to get to their final destination. The best choices depend on many factors, including price, speed, expected congestion, the final destination in New York, and one's aversion to breathing the air on the New Jersey Turnpike. This roadmap, which describes one's options at each junction, looks like a tree with its successively emerging branches, hence the term. The right way to choose such a map or tree is not to take the route whose first branch looks best, for example, because you would prefer driving to taking the train, when all other things are equal and then cross the Verrazano Bridge when you get to it. Instead, you anticipate the future decisions and use them to make your earlier choices. For example, if you want to go downtown, the PATH train would be superior to driving because it offers a direct connection from Newark. We can use just such a tree to depict the choices in a game of strategy, but one new element enters the picture. A game has two or more players. At various branching points along the tree, it may be the turn of different players to make the decision. A person making a choice at an earlier point must look ahead, not just to his own future choices, but to those of others. He must forecast what the others will do by putting himself figuratively in their shoes and thinking as they would think. To remind you of the difference, we will call a tree showing the decision sequence in a game of strategy a game tree, reserving decision tree for situations in which just one person is involved. Charlie Brown in Football and in Business. The story of Charlie Brown that opened this chapter is absurdly simple, but you can become familiar with game trees by casting that story in such a picture. Start the game when Lucy has issued her invitation, and Charlie faces the decision of whether to accept. If Charlie refuses, that is the end of the game. If he accepts, Lucy has the choice between letting Charlie kick and pulling the ball away. We can show this by adding another fork along this road. As we said earlier, Charlie should forecast that Lucy will choose the upper branch. Therefore, he should figuratively prune the lower branch of her choice from the tree. Now, if he chooses his own upper branch, it leads straight to a nasty fall. Therefore, his better choice is to follow his own lower branch. We show these selections by making the branches thicker and marking them with arrowheads. Are you thinking that this game is too frivolous? Here is a business version of it. Imagine the following scenario. Charlie, now an adult, is vacationing in the newly reformed, formerly Marxist country of Freedonia. He gets into a conversation with a local businessman named Frido, who talks about the wonderful profitable opportunities that he could develop given enough capital, and then makes a pitch. Invest $100,000 with me, and in a year I will turn it into $500,000, which I will share equally with you. So you will more than double your money in a year. The opportunity Frido describes is indeed attractive, and he is willing to write up a proper contract under Freedonian law. But how secure is that law? If at the end of the year Frido absconds with all the money, can Charlie, back in the United States, enforce the contract in Freedonian courts? They may be biased in favor of their national, or too slow, or bribed by Frido. So Charlie is playing a game with Frido, and the tree is as shown here. Note that if Frido honors the contract, he pays Charlie $250,000. Therefore, Charlie's profit is that minus the initial investment of $100,000, that is, $150,000. What do you think Frido is going to do? In the absence of a clear and strong reason to believe his promise, Charlie should predict that Frido will abscond, just as young Charlie should have been sure that Lucy would pull the ball away. In fact, the trees of the two games are identical in all essential respects. But how many Charlies have failed to do the correct reasoning in such games? What reasons can there be for believing Frido's promise? Perhaps he is engaged in many other enterprises that require financing from the United States or export goods to the United States. Then Charlie may be able to retaliate by ruining his reputation in the United States or seizing his goods. So this game may be part of a larger game. Perhaps an ongoing interaction that ensures Frido's honesty. But in the one-time version we showed above, the logic of backward reasoning is clear. We would like to use this game to make three remarks. First, different games may have identical or very similar mathematical forms, trees, or the tables used for depictions in later chapters. Thinking about them using such formalisms highlights the parallels and makes it easy to transfer your knowledge about a game in one situation to that in another. This is an important function of the theory of any subject. It distills the essential similarities in apparently dissimilar contexts and enables one to think about them in a unified and therefore simplified manner. Many people have an intrinsic aversion to theory of any kind, but we think this is a mistaken reaction. Of course, theories have their limitations. Specific contexts and experiences can often add to or modify the prescriptions of theory in substantial ways. But to abandon theory altogether would be to abandon a valuable starting point for thought, which may be a beachhead for conquering the problem. You should make game theory your friend and not a bugbear in your strategic thinking. The second remark is that Frito should recognize that a strategic Charlie would be suspicious of his pitch and not invest at all, depriving Frito of the opportunity to make $250,000. Therefore, Frito has a strong incentive to make his promise credible. As an individual businessman, he has little influence over Fredonia's weak legal system and cannot allay the investor's suspicion that way. What other methods may be at his disposal? We will examine the general issue of credibility and devices for achieving it in chapters 6 and 7. The third and perhaps most important remark concerns comparisons of the different outcomes that could result based on the different choices the players could make. It is not always the case that more for one player means less for the other. The situation where Charlie invests and Frito honors the contract is better for both than the one where Charlie does not invest at all. Unlike sports or contests, games don't have to have winners and losers. In the jargon of game theory, they don't have to be zero-sum. Games can have win-win or lose-lose outcomes. In fact, some combination of commonality of interest, as when Charlie and Frito can both gain if there is a way for Frito to commit credibly to honoring the contract, and some conflict, as when Frito can gain at Charlie's expense by absconding after Charlie has invested, coexist in most games in business, politics, and social interactions. And that is precisely what makes the analysis of these games so interesting and challenging. More complex trees. We turn to politics for an example of a slightly more complex game tree. A caricature of American politics says that Congress likes pork barrel expenditures and presidents try to cut down the bloated budgets that Congress passes. Of course, presidents have their own likes and dislikes among such expenditures and would like to cut only the ones they dislike. To do so, they would like to have the power to cut out specific items from the budget, or a line item veto. Ronald Reagan, in his State of the Union address in January 1987, said this eloquently. "Give us the same tool that 43 governors have a line item veto, so we can carve out the boondoggles and pork, those items that would never survive on their own." At first sight, it would seem that having the freedom to veto parts of a bill can only increase the president's power and never yield him any worse outcomes. Yet it is possible that the president may be better off without this tool. The point is that the existence of a line item veto will influence the Congress's strategies in passing bills. A simple game shows how. For this purpose, the essence of the situation in 1987 was as follows. Suppose there were two items of expenditure under consideration. Urban renewal, U, and an anti-ballistic missile system, M. Congress liked the former and the president liked the latter, but both preferred a package of the two to the status quo. The following table shows the ratings of the possible scenarios by the two players, in each case four being best and one worst. The tree for the game when the president does not have a line item veto is shown on the following page. The president will sign a bill containing the package of U and M, or one with M alone, but will veto one with U alone. Knowing this, the Congress chooses the package. Once again, we show the selections at each point by thickening the chosen branches and giving them arrowheads. Note that we have to do this for all the points where the president might conceivably be called upon to choose, even though some of these are rendered moot by Congress's previous choice. The reason is that Congress's actual choice is crucially affected by its calculation of what the president would have done if Congress had counterfactually made a different choice. To show this logic, we must show the president's actions in all logically conceivable situations. Our analysis of the game yields an outcome in which both sides get their second-best preference. Rating 3. Next, suppose the president has a line item veto. The game changes to the following. Now, Congress foresees that if it passes the package, the president will selectively veto U, leaving only M. Therefore, Congress's best action is now either to pass U only to see it vetoed, or pass nothing. Perhaps it may have a preference for the former, if it can score political points from a presidential veto, but perhaps the president may equally score political points by this show of budgetary discipline. Let us suppose the two offset each other, and Congress is indifferent with respect to the two choices, but either gives each party only their third best outcome, rating 2. Even the president is left worse off by his extra freedom of choice. This game illustrates an important general conceptual point. In single-person decisions, greater freedom of action can never hurt. But in games, it can hurt because its existence can influence other players' actions. Conversely, tying our own hands can help. We will explore this advantage of commitment in chapters 6 and 7. We have applied the method of backward reasoning in a game tree to a very trivial game, Charlie Brown, and extended it to a slightly more complicated game, the line item veto. The general principle remains applicable, no matter how complicated the game may be. But trees for games, where each player has several choices available at any point, and where each player gets several turns to move, can quickly get too complicated to draw or use. In chess, for example, 20 branches emerge from the root. The player with the white pieces can move any of his/her 8 pawns forward, 1 square or 2, or move one of his 2 knights in one of 2 ways. For each of these, the player with the black pieces has 20 moves. So we are up to 400 distinct paths already. The number of branches emerging from later nodes in chess can be even larger. Solving chess fully using the tree method is beyond the ability of the most powerful computer that exists or might be developed during the next several decades, and other methods of partial analysis must be sought. We will discuss later in the chapter how chess experts have tackled this problem. Between two extremes lie many moderately complex games that are played in business, politics, and everyday life. Two approaches can be used for these. Computer programs are available to construct trees and compute solutions. Alternatively, many games of moderate complexity can be solved by the logic of tree analysis, without drawing the tree explicitly. We illustrate this using a game that was played in a TV show that is all about games, where each player tries to outplay, outwit, and outlast the others. Strategies for Survivors. CBS's Survivor features many interesting games of strategy. In the 6th episode of Survivor, Thailand, the two teams or tribes played a game that provides an excellent example of thinking forward and reasoning backward, in theory and in practice. 21 flags were planted in the field of play between the tribes, who took turns removing the flags. Each tribe, at its turn, could choose to remove 1, 2, or 3 flags. Thus, 0, passing up 1's turn, was not permitted, nor was it within the rules to remove 4 or more at one turn. The team to take the last flag, whether standing alone or as a part of a group of 2 or 3 flags, won the game. The losing tribe had to vote out one of its own members, thus weakening it in future contests. In fact, the loss proved crucial in this instant, and a member of the other tribe went on to win the ultimate prize of $1 million. Thus, the ability to figure out the correct strategy for this game would prove to be of great value. The two tribes were named Suk Jai and Chue Gong, and Suk Jai had the first move. They started by taking 2 flags and leaving 19. Before reading on, pause a minute and think. If you were in their place, how many would you have chosen? Write down your choice somewhere and read on. To understand how the game should be played and compare the correct strategy with how the two tribes actually played, it helps to focus on two very revealing incidents. First, each tribe had a few minutes to discuss the game among its own members before the play started. During this discussion, within Chuai Gong, one of the members, Ted Rogers, an African-American software developer, pointed out, "At the end, we must leave them with four flags." This is correct. If Suk Jai faces four flags, it must take one or two or three, leaving Chuai Gong to take the remaining three or two or one respectively, at its next turn and win the game. Chuai Gong did in fact get and exploit this opportunity correctly. Facing six flags, they took two. But here is the other revealing incident. At the previous turn, just as Suk Jai returned from having taken three flags out of the nine facing them, the realization hit one of their members, Shi An, a feisty and articulate competitor who took considerable pride in her analytical skills. "If Chuai Gong now takes two, we are sunk." So Suk Jai's just completed move was wrong. What should they have done? Shi An, or one of her Suk Jai colleagues, should have reasoned as Ted Rogers did, but carried the logic of leaving the other tribe with four flags to its next step. How do you ensure leaving the other tribe with four flags at its next turn? By leaving it with eight flags at its previous turn. When it takes one or two or three out of eight, you take three or two or one at your next turn, leaving them with four as planned. Therefore, Suk Jai should have turned the tables on Chuai Gong and taken just one flag out of the nine. Shi An's analytical skill kicked into high gear one move too late. Ted Rogers perhaps had the better analytical insights, but did he? How did Suk Jai come to face nine flags at its previous move? Because Chuai Gong had taken two from 11 at its previous turn. Ted Rogers should have carried his own reasoning one step further. Chuai Gong should have taken three, leaving Suk Jai with eight, which would be a losing position. The same reasoning can be carried even farther back. To leave the other tribe with eight flags, you must leave them with 12 at their previous turn. For that, you must leave them with 16 at the turn before that, and 20 at the turn before that. So Suk Jai should have started the game by taking just one flag, not two, as it actually did. Then it could have had a sure win by leaving Chuai Gong with 20, 16, 4 at their successive turns. Does the first mover always have a sure win in all games? No. If the flags game started with 20 flags instead of 21, the second mover would have a sure win. And in some games, for example, the simple 3x3 tic-tac-toe, either player can ensure a tie with correct play. Now think of Chuai Gong's very first turn. It faced 19 flags. If it had carried its own logic back far enough, it would have taken 3, leaving Suk Jai with 16 and already on the way to certain defeat. Starting from any point in the middle of the game where the opponent has played incorrectly, the team with the turn to move can seize the initiative and win. But Chuai Gong did not play the game perfectly either. The table below shows the comparison between the actual and the correct moves at each point in the game. The entry "no move" means that all moves are losing moves if the opponent plays correctly. You can see that almost all the choices were wrong, except Chuai Gong's move when facing 13 flags, and that must have been accidental, because at their next turn they faced 11 and took 2 when they should have taken 3. Trip to the gym number 1. Let us turn the flag game into hot potato. Now you win by forcing the other team to take the last flag. It's your move and there are 21 flags. How many do you take? Before you judge the tribes harshly, you should recognize that it takes time and some experience to learn how to play even very simple games. We have played this game between pairs or teams of students in our classes and found that it takes Ivy League freshmen 3 or even 4 plays before they figure out the complete reasoning and play correctly all the way through from the first move. By the way, what number did you choose when we asked you to initially? And what was your reasoning? Incidentally, people seem to learn faster by watching others play than by playing themselves. Perhaps the perspective of an observer is more conducive to seeing the game as a whole and reasoning about it coolly than that of a participant. To fix your understanding of the logic of the reasoning, we offer you the first of our trips to the gym, questions on which you can exercise and hone your developing skills in strategic thinking. The answers are in the workouts section in the end of the book. Now that you are invigorated by this exercise, let us proceed to think about some general issues of strategy in this whole class of games. What makes a game fully solvable by backward reasoning? The 21 Flags game had a special property that made it fully solvable, namely, the absence of uncertainty of any kind. Whether about some natural chance elements, the other players' motives and capabilities, or their actual actions. This seems a simple point to make, but it needs some elaboration and clarification. First, at any point in the game when one tribe had the move, it knew exactly what the situation was, namely, how many flags remained. In many games, there are elements of pure chance, thrown up by nature or by the gods of probability. For example, in many card games, when a player makes a choice, he/she does not know for sure what cards the other players hold, although their previous actions may give some basis for drawing some inferences about that. In many subsequent chapters, our examples and analysis will involve games that have this natural element of chance. Secondly, the tribe making its choice also knew the other tribe's objective, namely, to win. And Charlie Brown should have known that Lucy enjoyed seeing him fall flat on his back. Players have such perfect knowledge of the other players or players' objectives in many simple games and sports, but that is not necessarily the case in games people play in business, politics, and social interactions. Motives in such games are complex combinations of selfishness and altruism. Concern for justice or fairness. Short-run and long-run considerations, and so on. To figure out what the other players will choose at future points in the game, you need to know what their objectives are and, in the case of multiple objectives, how they will trade one off against the other. You can almost never know this for sure, and must take educated guesses. You must not assume that other people will have the same preferences as you do, or as a hypothetical, rational person does, but must genuinely think about their situation. Putting yourself in the other person's shoes is a difficult task, often made more complicated by your emotional involvement in your own aims and pursuits. We will have more to say about this kind of uncertainty later in this chapter and at various points throughout the book. Here, we merely point out that the uncertainty about other players' motives is an issue for which it may be useful to seek advice from an objective third party, a strategic consultant. Finally, players in many games must face uncertainty about other players' choices. This is sometimes called strategic uncertainty to distinguish it from the natural aspects of chance, such as a distribution of cards or the bounce of a ball from an uneven surface. In 21 Flags, there was no strategic uncertainty because each tribe saw and knew exactly what the other had done previously. But in many games, players take their actions simultaneously or in such rapid sequence that one cannot see what the other has done and react to it. A soccer goalie facing a penalty kick must decide whether to move to his/her own right or left without knowing which direction the shooter will aim for. A good shooter will conceal his/her own intentions up to the last microsecond, by which time it is too late for the goalie to react. The same is true for serves and passing shots in tennis and many other sports. each participant in a sealed bid auction must make his or her own choice without knowing what the other bidders are choosing. In other words, in many games, the players make their moves simultaneously and not in a pre-assigned sequence. The kind of thinking that is needed for choosing one's action in such games is different from, and in some respects, harder than, the pure backward reasoning of sequential move games like 21 Flags. Each player must be aware